Well, well, well. Welcome back to another episode of Low Fi Lit. Today, I talked to William Dura, Misery Tourism, of Misery Clubs Company, of William's YouTube channel, of a culture magazine called The Last Estate. Okay, you have all the back information. Let's get to the show. I want to get to the show. I want to go. I hate intros. Let's go. Let's go. I'm ready. Here's the show. See ya. I found a bunch of articles where you were going to New York for the Occupy Wall Street like movement. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I'm super interested. Like, what articles did you find about that?
It was like there was a site called like the Press Republican.
Holy shit, man, you do your research. That's like 12 or more years old. I can talk about Occupy Wall Street a bit.
How'd you end up there? Like, I guess you were already political.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at that point I was in my mid-20s, I think. I think I would have been, so it was probably like 15 years ago. I was raised in a really conservative household, right? Like, I was raised in a very conservative, very Christian household. And that's kind of the, like, milieu I grew up in. And that's kind of, like, the like, political value system that I internalized, right? And then I went off to college, and I did, like, what a lot of dumb conservative kids do when they go off to college. And I became the polar fucking opposite, right? Like, I became a socialist. And I became like very, very leftist in my belief system, which is not something that, like, I don't want to be too hard on people who, like, either are themselves still very conservative or all are themselves, like, very left-leaning, right? Like, everyone is fully entitled to their belief system. But for me, I think it was like a kind of like reverse reactionary thing. Like, it was a, like, this is like, I see some glaring flaws in this worldview that I was raised in. Like, some of this seems incoherent. Some of it seems hypocritical. Some of it seems like out of sync with reality. So let me gravitate towards the polar opposite of that. And there was definitely like an aspect of like deep class resentment in there too, because we were raised pretty poor. And I always felt like I was very poor, right? Like, we weren't very poor. We weren't like, I never went hungry. We never went without like the actual necessities of life, but it was a struggle, right? My dad was a teaching assistant. My mom didn't work. She was home with the kids. It was, you know, probably making 35 grand a year or something in the 90s, which is more than it is now, but it's not a lot of money. So I always like carried a lot of like insecurity, let's say, about that, about class stuff. And so like that lingering sense that like of like class insecurity made me very, combined with like the reaction to my like conservative upbringing, like was a fertile ground for me to become like a communist, right? Like or a socialist, to become like, yeah. And so that was where I was at for college and for most of my 20s. And then, you know, the recession, the Great Recession hit just as I decided to drop out of grad school. So here I was, like, I had just dropped out of grad school.
Wait, wait, when did you graduate? When did you graduate your bachelor's?
2006, I believe.
Okay.
2006. And then I took a year, and then I was in grad school. I did a year of graduate school. I was in an English PhD program that That's a whole nother story. I got really disenchanted there. This is
what happened.
I have a pathological cycle. I get really into things and then like I experience them and then I become deeply disenchanted with them. And that's what happened with grad school. There's more to it there. It wasn't a totally irrational decision. There's a lot about the like culture of academia that I found out that really was at like odds with how who I am and how I function and what I want out of life.
Do you think if you went now, you would still like drop out eventually, or would you be able to go through it?
You know, honestly, man, I ask that myself that question a lot. Mm-hmm. Or I used to before learned helplessness really kicked my ass. And I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I definitely think that I've cultivated habits that would make that process easier for me, right? And I think that I've made some I think I have a more realistic view of how the world works, and I think like the degree to which like my decision to drop out was driven by naivete or by like a romantic idea of what working should look like, of what like study should look like. Yeah, I mean, maybe. Yeah.
How do you think it should be done?
My big problem, and this is really a problem, this really only applies to the humanities, right? This doesn't apply to the hard sciences. This doesn't apply to mathematics. But in terms of the humanities, the purpose of the arts is to make, it should be an outward facing connection with the world, right? With the culture as a whole, with society as a whole. And the insularity of how that's actually viewed in academia, where it's very much like the focus is on publishing in journals that have a very small audience, right? Like that are highly specific, that cover subject matter that no average human being could give a fraction of a fuck about. And the encouragement to write like this really tortured, jargon-filled, highly referential prose, like all that adds up to something that's very inward looking, right? It's the academy talking to the academy. It's the university system, it's professors within the university system having a bunch of conversations with each other that they're often themselves not very passionate about. That often, this might be my cynicism coming in, but that's often more about positioning themselves for promotion or tenure or whatever than anything else. So it's very like, and once again, that is fine in the hard sciences. That's fine in mathematics, where like the theory is an attempt to get at like some fundamental facts about reality that can then be like practically applied, right? Like if you don't have like real firm theoretical ideas about biological sciences, then like the applied sciences, like medicine, like there's a clear through line there, right? Like medicine is directly connected to like the theoretical, more abstract study of the biological sciences and so on. And you could talk about the combination between engineering and mathematics or physics and so on and so forth. But that's not how the humanities work. Like there is no, these theories that are being worked out behind closed doors about like poetics and about like all this stuff, even stuff that is, even the like cultural study stuff that in theory is about the larger culture, that stuff is fundamentally detached from the larger culture. That stuff has very little power to influence how art is actually created. And frankly, at those times when like academic discipline, academic ideas, right? Ideas from cultural studies or ideas from like, you know, aesthetic disciplines and ideas, when those ideas bleed out into larger culture and actually start influencing like the creation of the arts, it usually sucks, right? They make it measurably worse. So it doesn't seem valuable.
But you went in for a literature PhD, what did you go in expecting and what were you passionate about then that you ended up losing?
I think I was mostly just kind of abstractly, naively passionate about literature, period.
What did you love? What was your favorite stuff back then?
I was very into modern poetry. The modernist period, like Eliot, Eliot, Faulkner, and like the like later modern leading into most postmodern poets like John Berryman or like other confessional poets like Sylvia Plath, like that these are the authors who like really had a passionate impact on me when I was reading them as an undergraduate, you know.
Why didn't you go into writing or MFA, do an MFA?
You know, that's a good question. That's a whole nother struggle for me. When it comes to creative writing, I'm very slow. I'm very, inspiration comes hard and the words come even harder, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think to some degree, like why to the degree that I've found a niche within this space, in the independent literature space, it's been more as an editor than as, well, an editor and also like as a critic or a commentator more than it has been as an author, like as a poet or as a short story writer. Not that I haven't published poetry, not that I haven't published short stories, not that I haven't published pieces of creative writing, but that stuff, it's much more a struggle for me. It's not as sustainable. It's an agonizing process. And whereas editing work, whereas like commenting on work, whereas like the community building aspect to the degree that I've been involved with that, with Misery Loves Company, and even with Misery Tourism in different ways, that stuff comes more naturally to me, or at least it's a cleaner fit, which isn't to say that I don't have Word documents full of unfinished stories and unfinished poems and stuff that will never see the light of day, and that I won't keep struggling with that for my whole life, trying to create work that I really think is valuable, but yeah.
So when you went into your PhD, how soon is the turn coming where it's like, oh, I have to focus on these journals?
I think I came undone pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was only there for a year, right? I dropped out at the end of my first year. And by the end of my first semester, I was really considering it. And it really was a very powerful kind of culture shock thing. It was like a very like, oh, this is what this is. Why mm-hmm. I didn't have a cleaner understanding of what it is going in, like before I applied. But then again, like you have an abstract sense. You talk to professors, they tell you this is how the life is going to be, but you still romanticize it until like you really see it and viscerally.
Well, also like 10 years ago and back then, I don't think it was as transparent as to what goes on, especially at that age. Maybe people will still go in naive, but I think now you have more access maybe to learn what that life is going to be like. I don't know.
I think that's true, actually. I think in some way, kind of like I said before, I do think ideas from academia actually are starting to like have had a somewhat powerful influence, especially like cultural ideas that were once like kind of quarantined without in academia have in the last decade really escaped into the broader world. And often, like, to the credit of academics, like to the credit of people who like political scientists who study like race relations, to the credit even of like people who study like cultural studies, like African-American studies or queer studies within the humanities and social sciences, those ideas as expressed within academia are actually a lot more sophisticated and nuanced than the way than like the Tumblr version of them that mm-hmm. has like escaped the quarantine zone and created like over the course of the last decade or so, like permeated the larger society in a way that I think has mostly been a negative, if I'm being frank. Like, I don't feel like, well, that's a whole nother thing. But so I think that at least now people, whereas like a decade ago, there were, I think now at least there's, at least people have a like caricature of what academia is like. Like, mm-hmm. even if that caricature is somewhat detached from reality, is somewhat extreme, it is at least not nothing. And I think you're right that like when I was going in, there really was not much there, you know?
So like you drop out from your PhD.
Oh, yeah, I was going to talk about Occupy Wall Street, right? That's the initial question you asked. So yeah, I dropped out in 2008. The Great Recession had just hit. I'm still, even as I've become like somewhat jaundiced with everything that's going on in like on a college level, that it wasn't like an ideological response, right? I didn't like suddenly become conservative or something. I was still very, very much like a dyed-in-the-wool committed leftist. And so, yeah, I'm unemployed. I entered into this world where the economy has just collapsed and jobs are like not available. Right. Mm-hmm. So, that in some ways like gave this tangible aspect to what I already believed ideologically. It's like, yes, the economy is fundamentally fucking broken. And why wouldn't it be? Corporations, right? Like, why wouldn't it be the rich's fault? And to some degree, now don't get me wrong, like even today, I'm deeply skeptical of a lot of the perverse incentives that exist in the corporate world. I haven't become a libertarian, right? Mm-hmm. But in that moment, it was like, yeah, like this is 100% fucking right. And then the Occupy Wall Street movement started. And I'm unemployed. I'm living at home with my parents. I don't know what to do with myself. And here is this movement that like confirms my ideological priors. That is very much like, yes, these people have the right idea. This is how I see the world too. And I decided I'd go down there with some friends and spend a few days down there. And that was a profoundly eye-opening experience. But not at all in the way that I thought it was going to be. I left so disenchanted. That is one of the greatest like system shocks of my life was being on the ground at Occupy Wall Street and seeing my ideology in practice. And it was ugly. It was so ugly. It was profoundly ugly. I want to be careful here because I know there are, I don't want to come off as this being a sweeping ideological condemnation of anarchism or leftism or progressivism or any of these ideas that I still have some affection for, that like, but on an interpersonal level there on the ground, it was like being subjected to one pathological narcissist after another. It was one really visibly sick human being who needed help that this movement was obviously not going to provide after another. And it was not at all like, and then I say this as someone who struggles with mental illness and who is very open about that and who is very much like not the kind of person who thinks that like that's deserving a blanket condemnation or that, but like this was not, here were a lot of people with profound problems, and this movement was exacerbating those problems, not helping to ameliorate them, right? Like nobody there seemed happier for being there. Whatever like utopian ideas about community I might have had going in and they might have had going in dissolved upon impact with other human beings. It's like what Dostoevsky says, right? Like there are a lot of the idea that it's so easy to love humanity in the abstract, but then to hate individual human beings and vice versa, right? Like,
what do you think it would have to do to like be like have a successful, profound impact on you?
I think that if I had gone there and on a human level, I had felt a real connection to these people, I think if I had found them humble, if I had found them compassionate, if I had found them welcoming, then ideology wouldn't have mattered, right? Like, and I think, and this is something that like is broadly culturally true. This is what really happens to people, right? This is how people end up in cults and shit, because like if you are a lost person in deep pain with a fractured sense of self, as I was in that moment, right? And with real needs that are not being met by society, and you're welcomed, like you're welcomed into a group, like a group actually compassionately welcomes you. They're, however, like cuckoo nuts, their beliefs, sorry, it doesn't fucking matter, right? You can come to believe anything if it's provided, if your other needs, if your interpersonal and emotional needs are met along the way, if your psychological needs are met along the way, the fundamental underlying ideology don't fucking matter. It does not fucking matter. You will believe some absolutely, you will believe that you should fucking drink the poison so that the UFO can come and pick you up. You will believe that eventually if the group is welcoming and if the group like is providing you, providing for your emotional, psychological, or tangible needs. And vice versa, you could have a group of people who actually have a coherent idea of how the world functions, like who are actually dead fucking on about the ways in which society is broken and corrupt. But if they're a bunch of narcissists, if they're a bunch of dickheads, if you encounter them and they're a bunch of jerks and you see them squabbling with each other, you see them like literally fighting each other in the dirt, it doesn't matter. You'll assume that the knowledge they have to give you is bogus, that it's garbage, that it has no value for you, right?
Do you think you would have fit in? Or do you think you would have like, if it had been a cult, do you think you would have been into it?
I mean, I can't say who I would be if I had arrived there and found it to be like an actually like communal and welcoming kind of utopian situation. I would be a profoundly different human being than I am now. And I'm actually honestly glad. I mean, at the time it was painful because it was like, you think this is how, you think this is what you want. Like you're desperate for this thing. And it's also like the sense that like here, like, after all of this time, here this movement is rising up to finally address these things you see as being profound structural problems in society. Like, here is the transformative moment for this society. Like, here's the moment shit's finally going to change. Like, it really hurts to go there thinking that's what you're walking into and having the polar opposite experience and walk away disenchanted. That,
and this was already right after you walked out of your PhD.
Yeah, right. I mean, and once again, this speaks to my own pathology, right? Like, I'm somebody who's much more easily discouraged than encouraged.
But it's funny because it's like, so those two things happen, and then like 2 years later, you do a Kickstarter with Rudy for the Misery Tourism game. So like that foundation, that now makes a lot more sense to me to have you have that background of being like disappointed like that, and then you create Misery Tourism board game.
Yeah, that's true. It was only a few years after that. I mean, that to some degree,
was that connected?
That's a good question, and I think it's a complicated one to answer. Definitely at that moment in life, I'm feeling deeply disenchanted, deeply disillusioned. And that deep disenchantment and disillusionment, I mean, it's right there on the page in the early Misery Tourism stuff, undoubtedly. Like, if you look at the games in the Misery Index, if you go deep in the archives and you look at some of my earliest writing published on Misery Tourism, it's the writing of a really bitter, angry, cynical human being who, like, maybe has, like, the thinnest veneer of humor over the top of that, right? And so that's definitely the case, right? That emotional strain, like the disenchantment I felt, the disillusionment I felt, certainly fed into that. Also, though, that's very much a function of my relationship with Rudy, too, right? The areas on which we bonded are apparent in those games, you know, that. And one of the areas that, like, Rudy and I connected on is that, like, cynicism, is that love of exploring, like, darker, more like, yeah, like, darker themes and being willing to look unflinchingly, at least I thought at the time, at, like, quote-unquote offensive subject matter. And that's something I very much shared with Rudy. And also at the time, like, a love of role-playing games, a love of, like, design and all of those things. And yeah, so it was very much a kind of, like, what's the term? Like, foil-a-deux or whatever. I think I'm mispronouncing it. But, like, a madness shared by two people, right? Like, the two of us synced up in a way that hopefully that led to real creative stuff, that led to real creative output, and it led to something that I'm still very proud of in Misery Tourism. But certainly also, like, there was a hint of, like, insanity there too, and a hint of, like, feeding each other's worst impulses as well. there's no universe in which I stay in the PhD program and Misery Tourism then exists. And there's probably no universe in which, like, I remain a committed leftist and get really involved in progressive politics. And I was at the time, like, I was involved in some local political campaigns. I was involved in, like, some progressive organizing. I think there would have had to be a reckoning eventually, and that, like, only one of those three people could have survived, right? Like, mm-hmm. Either I end up in academia, I end up with my PhD in English literature and I'm teaching at a university somewhere, or I end up deeply committed to progressive politics, or I end up with Misery Tourism, right? And I'm not, because, like, you can't, certainly, like, if I was involved in political organizing or something, Misery Tourism would be a stain on that. It would be something, even, like, it was even something that when I was working in the nonprofit sector, for a little while, I, like, changed my name and I was, like, operating under a pseudonym with Misery Tourism. Because, like, you know, like,
yeah,
to have to rationalize this, you don't want to be called into your boss's office and shown Misery Tourism, do you?
Yeah. Were you, when you were in your PhD, were you talking to Rudy? Were you still friends with Rudy at that time?
Yeah. Rudy and I have been friends since second fucking grade. We met on the playground in second grade. And we remained friends because for most of my adult life, I've spent more time online than offline.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if though I was in Pennsylvania doing my PhD and then later living in New Hampshire when I was working, like, I was online anyway, and Rudy was online anyway, so we very much stayed in contact during those times, and, yeah.
These stories you're telling, they kind of parallel a little bit with, like, Unity's book?
Yes, and I loved Unity's book, and I felt the same thing, especially, like, it's funny, because he and I, it is he now, because he's going by Matthias, but, yeah, no, he and I have had, like, weirdly parallel and, like, also very different lives in that, like, I'm fundamentally, like, a deeply risk averse guy, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't do drugs. I don't even drink. And I was, like, subject, you know, as a teenager, my friends were like, yeah, you know, like, have a drink. And I don't know. I think it became, like, one thing you need to understand maybe about me is, like, I'm someone where if you apply peer pressure to me, like, all that does is create, like, profound, like, reactionary resentment. So the fact that somebody was like telling me to do this was probably enough to convince me that I didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I decided at a fairly young age that I wasn't going to drink, and I've stuck with it my whole life, you know? So in that sense, and in a lot of senses, like, I live a really, like, on a, like, personal level, like, live a deeply buttoned up life, which is profoundly different than the life that Unity has lived. But yet, there's these deep parallels here. There's the dropping out of graduate school, the involvement with, like, the Occupy movement and progressive politics, the disillusionment with that, and then, like, ending up back living with your parents for a while, you know? And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just a millennial thing. Maybe a lot of millennial lives have an arc like that.
Have you always been so, like, you're very analytical. You're, like, really good. Like, when you do the Misery Loves Company, like, you can hear a piece and just, like, go off on this, like gorgeous analysis, this, like, profound analysis of each piece. Like, how do you do that? Have you always been able to do that?
I don't... First of all, thank you. Like, I really do appreciate that. I wish I could answer that question. I wish I could give you a good answer for that question, because I don't want to answer in a way that makes me sound like a dickhead. And I don't also want to give an answer that, like, gives a false impression of, like, the amount of preparation that I do going into, like, Misery Loves Company, because I don't read these pieces in advance. I don't do any kind of prep for
wow.
I show the fuck up, I turn, and then I mean, some pieces I have read in advance if we publish them, mm-hmm. right? But the pieces that we haven't published usually are pieces that I've never read before, never heard before, and the, like, criticism I give is extemporaneous, and it doesn't seem like super insightful or super profound to me, if I'm being honest. Like, it really is just a, like, I'm listening and I'm responding with my, like, knee-jerk encouragement, right? I do want, the thing I really want from people, that I really want people to experience when they come to Misery Loves Company, is I want them to feel like their work has been seen, that it's been understood, and it's been validated. Because authors don't fucking get much of that, because mm-hmm. indie lit is so, like, it's so profoundly unrewarding on a very basic yeah. level. Like, authors' work often doesn't get read, and if it does get read, the response is like, oh yeah, this is my friend, so I'll like it, or I'll retweet it. And, or I'll pay $10 and buy his book. But in terms of, like, receiving, like, substantive, like, support, in terms of, like, feeling like somebody has read your work and understood it and seen what you were trying to accomplish with it, that's hard to come by. That's really hard to come by. And that's what a lot of authors, I think, like, really are yearning for. I mean, it's something that I know that when it comes to, like, my own work, I really appreciate it when somebody, like, gets it, you know. So I try very hard when someone reads to, with, in the best of my ability, get what they were trying to do, and then let them know that what they were trying to do was actually pretty fucking cool, mm-hmm. right?
this past week, I think it was Josh Sherman, he was bringing up the fact that maybe there should be more, like, constructive criticism at the Misery Loves Company. What do you think? Do you agree or disagree?
I disagree as far as Misery Loves Company is concerned. Mm-hmm. I think in the larger space of independent literature, it would be good if there were more, and I don't think this is actually something you would do in the form of a reading, the way that Misery Loves Company is an online reading, right? I think it would be good to have more, like, workshop groups, like more people who get together, as a group, over Zoom, over, like, Google Meet like this, over mm-hmm. or in Discord, over DM or whatever, on a regular basis, and read and critique each other's work. Like, those kind of, like, closed circles of writers, I think historically are really important, especially when you're trying to establish a kind of common literary movement. I mean, you can look at something like the Lovecraft Circle or the Inklings with Tolkien or something. Like, genre literature as we understand it today wouldn't exist without these closed societies. And you see it with artistic movements, right, too. You see it in things like modern poetry would not be what it is if Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot didn't have this like close, intimate, and like deeply constructive and reciprocal creative relationship. So I think we do need more of that. Like, I think we need, like, we have enough like exhibitionist behavior, like people going on Twitter, like, read my shit. And seeking encouragement and validation that way. And it would be good if there were like closed, tight, intimate circles of people where there was a lot of like deeply constructive engagement with each other's readings. And I think that would include criticism. I mean, look at what Ezra Pound did to The Wasteland, right? Like, mm-hmm. he tore that apart. Like, he cut huge sections out of it. And the result was one of the most important poems in history, period. And I think one of the like most emotionally moving poems, like most powerful poems in history. So to answer Josh, yes, I think there needs to be more spaces for real constructive criticism in independent literature. I don't think something like Misery Loves Company is the right forum for that. And the reason for that is Misery Loves Company is not that, right? It's not a workshop. It's a place for people to come and present their work to a hopefully receptive and interested audience. And the fact that I also offer what I consider not like critique, but encouragement about the work, like in like largely honest, like emotional response to the work, like, that I offer that, like, try to offer that kind of understanding and validation, I see as like part of my job as like the MC, right, as the host. I'm not the professor. I didn't want to be a professor. I'm not.
You come off like one, though. I think everyone thinks of you as one.
But that's not how I see my role in Misery Loves Company, right? I'm not. Every once in a while, if somebody asks for constructive feedback, like, how could I change this? I'll try to offer that. Or if there's something, if I really love a piece and there's something that's just like, oh shit, I wish they hadn't made that one creative choice, sometimes I'll sneak that in. Mm-hmm. But I don't see that as like what Misery Loves Company is about, right? Very much a space to like exhibit and perform your work.
So are you going to like create workshops for like Misery Tourism? And like,
I hadn't thought about it. I don't know. Let's see how people respond to the podcast. I don't know. I've never really thought about like doing a more workshop-y thing. And a lot of the writing workshop stuff feels a little scammy to me. It's like,
why?
I think because it's very unlikely that you're going to go into a writing workshop and ever get a return on that investment monetarily, right? Like, regardless of how small that investment is.
Well, I don't think people are expecting that, though. I think they're going in because they want to write and have like that external structure around people that they are maybe friends with, and maybe they want to support. You know?
That's a fair point. I think you're absolutely right. And I think on that level, if people come in with that understanding, if they come into the workshop understanding that they're paying because like whoever they really actually do respect, like, whoever's running the workshop as a craftsman, and they really do want to learn a little bit about how they engage with their craft, what they do, like how they approach it, and maybe pick up some of their techniques and stuff, with the full understanding that it's never going to translate into a career in writing.
Yeah.
With the full understanding that it may not even help you get published, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're entering it on that level, then the more power to you, you know?
Like, would you ever start one with Josh?
Like the two of us together? No.
No?
No, I don't think that would be... I don't know. I think Josh and I... It's interesting because I think Josh and I have similar aesthetic sensibilities for the most part, although I don't think they overlap perfectly. I do think Josh is a lot more into autofiction and that spirit things. And I think I'm coming from a place more deeply influenced. I think I have more influence. Like, Josh seems to be someone who has very little interest in like speculative fiction and genre fiction and stuff. And I think I do have more interest there. Although that doesn't necessarily mean we'd be like, that we'd clash. I think the real clash, though, between us would be an interpersonal one. I think we have profoundly different interpersonal styles. And,
oh, for real?
and I don't know that they would necessarily be... I don't know, Josh, if you're listening to this, shoot me a DM. Who knows? Josh is not afraid to be abrasive. And there's a space for that. Like, he's very willing to play the heel. And I think indie lit needs heels. Like, not everyone can be out there trying to, like... be liked. And I think he's very good at it. I think he's very good at that. And he's very good at playing the heel in a way that doesn't make him just come off like a dickhead, doesn't just make him come off as an asshole. He's willing to be very like self-effacing in the way that he plays the heel and self-aware. So it's like, oh, okay, like, you're kind of being a jerk right now, but also you're aware of your own, like, whatever, like the ways in which, like, you are coming off as a jerk, right? You're aware of your own interpersonal foibles. And so it's less abrasive and it's more charming, but I don't know. I don't know. I
was going to ask you about, YouTube, because you had done that for a while before ending it and moving on to back to the magazine. Did you get disillusioned with that after you had started it?
No, actually, no. I'm coming back. I have, for the last few months, been in a real creative funk that has, like, I haven't really written and published new work in like a year.
You've been reading new pieces, though.
No, I've only this. So I did read at a couple of Misery Loves Companies. I read for Kat's reading because she asked me to, and I read for Unity's reading because he asked me to. But in both cases, I read older pieces. The piece I read during Kat's reading was from 2021, I think, and then one I read from Unity was for Unity's was like from 2019.
Wow.
So no, I haven't. I have unfinished it that I've been like churning over. So broadly speaking, I haven't done much writing. I haven't done much on the Substack, including like writing and the like interviews and podcast stuff. And I haven't recorded a YouTube video in several months now. But none of those things are abandoned. None of those things have been like fully walked away from. I've been actually lately putting a lot of thought into like the YouTube thing in particular, because that was really cool because I got to reach an entirely new audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whereas usually with the Substack or with Misery Tourism or with my own writing, with my other writing, excuse me, it's very much like trying to bootstrap onto the existing audience, the audience that I've already built, and like push the boundaries of that outward. Whereas with YouTube, the algorithm exposed me to a bunch of people who were in no way adjacent to the Misery Tourism world. And that was super cool. And I'd like to go back to doing that. It's more a matter of like having an idea that I feel is worthy of a video and coming up with a better way to approach the videos that make them easier to record and easier to edit, because I do get a lot of anxiety when I sit down in front of the camera. And what I did for my existing videos is I would, at most, I'd have notes, right? Mm-hmm. At most I would have like an outline of what I wanted to say, and then I would sit in front of the camera and say something, and then I'd be like, oh, that's not quite right, and then I would start again and again and catch myself, and then ultimately I'd be left with like an hour and a half or more sometimes of rambling that I had to edit down into a coherent, maybe 30-minute video. And that was not the right way to approach it. That made the whole process more organized, more excuse me, then.
I have that with my podcast. I'll like sit down. I'll get like 8 hours of like me just rambling on, and then I have to like edit it together into like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. And so I want to approach it in a more like structured and scripted way, maybe with like separate discrete shots instead of trying to do it all in one long take. And that's something I've been kicking around right now. And I think once I have an idea for what I really want to say, that's going to be the next thing to do. Sorry, I'm just going to very quickly go check on those chickens.
Okay. I will be back. No problem.
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that.
No problem.
All 10 chickens were in fact in and accounted for, so there were no fatalities. So we're
going. Oh, nice. When you do your YouTube series, have you thought about just focusing on Succession, because it seemed like those got the higher numbers? Or do you feel like you want to speak about whatever you want instead of trying to like stick to what people are going to bring in big numbers?
I think mostly the latter. I started doing the Succession stuff that was like somewhat like cynical and opportunistic, right? Which isn't to say that I didn't really enjoy the show, and I actually, sorry, I'm just
you're good.
I'm a lot of breath here. I ran up the stairs. I really did enjoy the show. I really actually honestly think it's one of the greatest television series ever made. And it's certainly one of my favorites. And it certainly exists at this wonderful intersection of a lot of things that really interest me and that I really love. Oh, hello, Ellie. The cat's talking to me. but also like it was in the midst of the final season. I knew I wanted to fuck around with YouTube anyway. So I was like, I bet the algorithm is looking for Succession content. I bet there is a demand for this. And sure enough, there was. But would I want to do that like
every episode, like a review?
Yeah, I don't think so. I have a couple of people I'm subscribed to, a couple of channels where like they fully commit to like a one or two television series. Like there's one guy, he does The Sopranos and he does Breaking Bad, and that's basically all he talks about all the time. And I'm not sure I could be that guy for Succession. I mean, I'm not sure I would want to be. I think there is a lot, there's a lot of depth and there's a lot of nuance to that series, and I think somebody really could go episode by episode and really dig into it. But that level of like specialization is always something that I've kind of been averse to. I do think too that demand for that has gone down some. Like the thing about The Sopranos and Breaking Bad is that they have these like deeply committed fandoms, right? There are people who like are Sopranos guys and they're like obsessed with the show and they don't care that it's 25 years old.
Oh yeah.
Excuse me. And I'm not sure that Succession has exactly that kind of a devoted, passionate, obsessive following, although frankly, it fucking deserves to have one.
I think in 5 years, we'll see if it does or not.
And maybe in 5 years, I'll only be making Succession videos if I have to. I'd like to expand outward and try some other things. And I've had some of the other pieces I've done on YouTube have done okay numbers, nothing close to like, my best Succession one got like 22 or 23,000 views. But it needs to be something I feel passionate about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially since at this point in time, I'm not making a tremendous amount of money off of YouTube or anything, just like, and even if a video got like 10,000 views or something, that would be a pretty trivial amount of money. So it's like, if I'm just fucking around with this anyway, I want it to be something that I'm passionate about. I want it to feel like a form of self-expression for me.
If they made 20,000 like views on each video, how much would you have made?
So it would depend on how frequently I release videos. And the video that got 20,000 views is also the video that got me monetized. So I didn't really get to see exactly what that would mean money-wise. I don't think it'd be a tremendous. I think if you released a video every week and every video got in the neighborhood of like 25,000 views, you might make a few hundred bucks a month or something. It's not wow. like, it wouldn't be like live off of money, right? Like if you wanted to live off of YouTube, you would have to be doing two things. You would have to have videos that regularly got in the 100K plus range in terms of views. And you would also need to have like a Patreon page, which would be something you could easily have if you're getting video, if your videos are frequently getting in the tens or hundreds of thousands of views. So the people who are like, the people who are have actually made it their living are doing one of two things. Either they're releasing content with great regularity that usually ends up in the tens of thousands, you know, of views, like channels that do like news stuff where they have mm-hmm. something to report on every day, right? Or like the video essay guys who like put a lot of work in, but the video, they know the video is going to hit 150,000 views or something.
Yeah.
Those are, so they can like release one every month or something. And also those guys, once again, they, because their persona is so much of what they do, and because they have like really a kind of parasocial relationship with the people who watch yeah. them, people are much more likely to support them on Patreon and things like that. So that's, at least that's kind of what I've grokked. Like this is not obviously based on like my own personal experiences. I've not had that kind of success, you know.
But a lot of those people too, they have like huge teams that are also working alongside them. Have you thought about adding like Derek or other people to your own YouTube and seeing if you could like rack up views that way or attention?
I think I would say that actually most YouTubers don't have much of a team.
Oh, they don't?
I mean, if you're talking about somebody like Mr. Beast, right, who gets tens of millions of views and yeah. is making an unbelievable amount of money, like who's making millions of dollars, yes, he has a whole fucking team. But if you talk about these guys, these video essay guys who regularly get like 150K views or something on a video, I think, and this is based more on research than on direct knowledge, it's them and they might have an editor, right? Like when they reach a certain point, if they're releasing with a certain regularity, they might pay someone to edit their videos, but it's usually not much more than a couple of people. Some of these channels that are like more of a newsfeed kind of thing that release videos daily, like there are some gaming channels I follow that really want to release a video whenever there's like new news about Switch hardware or something.
Yeah.
They usually have a small team of people, like five or six people, because they need to release videos like whenever something happens and they need to release a lot of videos.
But have you thought about making like Derek releases a video Monday, you release a video Tuesday, Rudy releases one the next day?
I think you could do some, what you could do, and what I have seen done on YouTube, like a fair amount, is you could have independent creators with their own channels who collaborate in different ways,
yeah.
right? Who maybe they all have their own channel, but they do a weekly podcast together that's on a channel where all of these creators get together and they discuss their work, or they discuss topics that are shared in common with their audience and things like that. But I don't think that there's, I don't honestly think it's super smart to have a bunch of people collaborating on the same channel, because I think there'd be a real diminishing returns. And because you can actually get the network effects that you would get from that while allowing people to have their own channels that are separately monetized, that are also that where the algorithm is learning from their specific audience too, learning to better serve to the person who wants to see Derek's videos. And there might be in this, and Derek actually does have his own channel.
Yeah.
It's good. But like there might be like in the Venn diagram of Derek's channel and my channel, let's say both of our channels have grown substantially in this scenario, there might be a fair amount of overlap there too, right? But if we merge that into one channel, then the people at the fringes of that Venn diagram might get filtered out by the algorithm, might get lost. Whereas if Derek has his own channel that's perfectly tuned to his audience, and I have my own channel that's perfectly tuned to mine. And we do a podcast together every Saturday night or something, where people from my channel can see Derek and people from Derek's channel can see my or me or whatever. Like, that allows more people to be filtered in without people being filtered out, if that makes any sense.
No, yeah, that makes sense. So have you thought about doing YouTube videos about your own life, about like the Occupy Wall Street or about dropping out?
Certainly I've done writing about my own life, right? Some of the writing on my Substack deals with exactly that, like deals with Occupy Wall Street and my disenchantment with that and my disenchantment with politics more broadly and struggles with religion and with like the culture of independent literature. I don't think I would want to do that on YouTube, which isn't to say that I wouldn't incorporate like anecdotes from my life or use things that I've learned from my life on YouTube, but I don't really want an auto-fictional YouTube channel.
You know,
because for the same reason that I want to try YouTube at all, which is it's kind of seeking a different audience, and it's seeking a different way to relate to that audience, and it's seeking a different subject matter, different tone. Like, it's very much trying to cultivate something that feels different than Misery Tourism, that like is profoundly different in subject matter, that isn't like mired in the dark, depressive, cynical, bleak subject matter of Misery Tourism. Not that I don't love that stuff, not that I don't think love what we publish and think that a lot of great literature comes out of that, but it's great to have another outlet that is totally not that. And likewise, it's great to have my Substack to do that kind of like often deeply uncomfortable personal writing. That's very much supposed to be about like looking inwards and like finding fault within myself just as much as finding fault within the larger society and finding like inconsistencies and insecurities within myself. But to also have another outlet that's very much not that, where I can be like, where I can try to be like optimistic or gregarious or talk about things, art that I'm really passionate about, and not have it be an exercise in like existential navel gazing, at least not in the same way.
Is it easier to put that out if it's like compartmentalized through YouTube, through Substack, through Misery Tourism, instead of it all being one thing or under one thing?
That's an interesting question, and it's a difficult question. I'm somewhat by like my knee-jerk response is that this stuff is compartmentalized out of necessity, right? Because that's where the audience exists to do the kind of thing that I'm trying to do in each of those spaces, and that like collapsing that all together might seem kind of just schizophrenic or incoherent.
You think?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, there's definitely an advantage to having a single unified persona and be doing a single thing, right?
Yeah.
Because when it is siloed, when it is compartmentalized, it keeps the audience for one thing from really bleeding into the next. It means that like you end up with like a bunch of smaller audiences instead of one big audience. But I've never found like the means to, I've never found the thing that I felt comfortable making the entirety of my life about. And I'm a person who does a lot of compartmentalizing. And this speaks to like the pathological thing I was saying earlier. Like, I'm someone who's actually very comfortable peddling different versions of myself to different people.
Yeah, me too.
And I don't think that's, some people say, oh, that means you're being manipulative, that means you're being insincere. But I don't think any of those versions of myself are being insincere. And I don't think most of those versions are necessarily manipulative in any way. I mean, there is always like a desire to tell people what they want to hear, but that's universal, right? Like all human beings experience that. But I actually think there's value in having a fairly fluid sense of self, being able to like be different people in different situations and see different versions of yourself and play with different versions of yourself, as long as like And this is the key fucking thing. And like, if I could look into the camera for a minute or whatever and give like one moral lesson here or one like piece of fucking advice, it's like the key thing is that the guy you are in a vacuum, when you're not talking to anyone else, when you're not trying to sell anything, when you're not trying to persuade anyone, when you're not trying to pacify or mollify or whatever another human being, like when it's just you in a vacuum, when it's just you in a mirrored room, you have to be, and this is going to sound fucking corny as shit, but it's true, you have to be able to love yourself. You 100% have to be able to like find some source of light, some source of love, some source of sincere belief inside yourself that will exist when you're not receiving external stimuli, when you're not receiving external support or approval or distraction or whatever else. And that's not something you will ever get from another human being. No other human being will ever fucking give that to you. And if you can't find that, you will destroy yourself. As someone who, like, for whom it took a long time to get there, who like spent large parts of my life really like mired in self-loathing, really mired in insecurity and resentment and hate and everything else, like if you can't find the way to be a thing that you can love in a vacuum, nothing else is going to work, you know?
How long did it take you to get to that point and for that lesson to come through for you?
Let's see. I turned 40 in under a month. I don't know, 38 years, and I'm not there yet. So maybe, but I think it's only been, and this is something where like misery tourism has actually really helped. It's helped me like move past some of the like resentment and bitterness and deep insecurities that I felt and see that like there are things I'm capable of doing that can like be positive, that can be simply positive, that can just be good for other people and good for me, you know? But no, I mean, up until, it's only the last few years of my life that I've been able to take real measurable steps in that direction. I think that like, there's always been some capacity for that. I'm not somebody who has really like struggled with true like self-hatred for most of my life. It's not like I've spent my life like unequivocally hating myself and wanting to destroy myself, although I certainly have been suicidal at multiple different occasions. But what was I saying? But like, so there's always been like that desire within me, right? Like the desire to like become the person who's capable of that kind of like unambiguous, if you want to call it self-love. Self-love sounds like narcissistic. It sounds sick, but it's necessary, right? Like there's always part of myself that wanted to be capable of that. But I think it's only within the last few years that I've been anyway become capable of that. And it's come at the cost of a tremendous amount of pain and introspection and cognitive dissonance and confusion and everything else. But it's been, in my opinion, it's been worth it too, you know, not to get too like, sound too much like a fucking motivational speaker or whatever.
When you have, so when you like run Misery Loves Company and you have people like very young, younger people like John or Jan or Molaine come into this place, do you have this sense that you're like, you have a sense of responsibility to look out?
Of responsibility for everyone who comes to Misery Loves Company. I have a sense of responsibility for everyone we publish. And I don't think it's an age thing, really, because you have people like Keith, right? Who are, he's in his 70s and he just started writing a few years ago. That's fucking wonderful. And I feel like I have a tremendous responsibility to Keith to like provide him with encouragement, to make sure that he doesn't feel like just because he started writing later in life, he like somehow should feel like otherized, like, or ostracized, or like he doesn't belong in the community. But yeah, that also applies to younger people as well.
But it's like they're so young and they could be spending their time doing anything else. And here they are, like, on a Friday night coming and hanging out with a bunch of, like, 30 and 40 year olds.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I mean,
it is cool. I mean, it's cool that Misery Loves Company casts such a wide net, right? Like, that the youngest regular might be in their early 20s and the oldest regular might be, let's say 75, right? Mm-hmm. That's fucking huge. And that speaks to, like, that speaks to something that only the arts can do. You know, like, there are a few other hobbies that have that kind of reach. But that, like, literature has that kind of universal appeal, potentially. And, but I do think anyone who comes, I want them to, first of all, like, feel validated when they read their work, feel encouraged when they read their work. And I also want them to be, like, in a community where they feel like other people in that community have something to offer them as an artist, you know? And I think that goes for someone like John or Jan, and for someone like Keith or Blick or like the rest of us, like, middle-aged dudes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think it applies to us as well, you know?
Do you see it as, like, a branching but different community from Misery Tourism? As becoming
Misery Loves Company?
Yeah.
Not intentionally so, but I think in like a de facto way, yes, because we've done partnerships with other magazines, other publications, other presses that have some overlap with the Misery Tourism audience. But not complete overlap. And actually, one of the really cool things that I found when we reopened submissions to Misery Tourism is that a number of people who had been to Misery Loves Company, and who especially, like, had been to, like, one of those crossover readings or something, but had never submitted to Misery Tourism in the past, submitted this time around. And that was really gratifying. And I think that it's so did, like, actually answer your question. I kind of see, like, Misery Loves Company as, like, an ambassador program for Misery Tourism. Like, right? Like, that's the, like, hand reaching out. Because the work we publish on Misery Tourism can be, like, very alienating or very off-putting or make people think, oh, well, like, maybe I like reading some of this, but maybe I'm a little scared of these guys. Like, this doesn't seem, like, cozy or comfortable. This doesn't seem like it would necessarily be an outlet that would be super accepting of my work. So to have this other branch of it that I hope is very much the opposite of that feels welcoming, that feels open, that feels supportive, I think helps to balance the scales in some way and make people who might not otherwise want to engage with Misery Tourism actually feel comfortable doing so.
Did this message of this self-love, did that come after Eris's passing?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think this is a difficult question to answer, because Eris's death really fucked me up, as I think it fucked up a lot of people involved in, like, our sphere of literature, right? And I think one of the ways that it fucked me up is it kind of made me question our mission at Misery Tourism. And it kind of made me question the efficacy of what we were doing. And it wasn't the only reason that we, like, stopped publishing. It was one of many complicated and interconnected reasons. But there was a period there where I was like, is the work that we're publishing actually fucking good? And I mean that, like, in the ethical sense. I don't mean that in the quality sense. I've never had any doubt that, like, that most of the work we publish is good from a quality perspective. But, like, are we doing social harm here in some way? I authentically went through a period where I thought about that, and I wondered about that, because I thought, and once again, this isn't just Eris, but I did think about Eris, and I did think about how that played out, and I had a lot of regrets, because she came to Misery Loves Company a fair amount, And I don't know, like, was that an experience? Like, I don't want to put this the wrong way, but was this a supportive and therapeutic experience for her as a human being? Or was this something that was like another thing enabling a darker pattern, you know? And that's the thing that I do worry about, and that I worried about then, and that I continue to worry about independent lit, outsider lit as a space in like my darker moments when I look in the mirror, and maybe when I don't see self-love reflected back, I do wonder about that. I do wonder, like, is this, is the work that we're publishing helping people get perspective in a way that helps them, that is cathartic, that's legitimately cathartic, that helps them move beyond their demons on some level, helps them exercise their demons, or at least helps them learn how to live with them in a healthy way? Or is it just the demons, right? Like, is it just the cycle perpetuating itself? And would it be better if they went, like, if they found religion? Or would it be better if they got involved in politics? Or if they went to rehab again? Or if they, like, got involved in some social community that was completely detached from all of that, completely, like, that was a million miles away from their mental illness, from their addiction, from their, like, would that be better? I don't fucking know, man. I spent most of my life as a publisher telling myself the other narrative, and writing the other narrative, and publishing the other narrative, and vocally defending the other narrative, that no, like, the purpose of this kind of literature is that it offers a safe and healthy outlet for this darkness, that it offers. I don't love the word therapeutic. I'm not a big fan of the word therapeutic, but cathartic, at least. Cathartic and, like, a cathartic outlet for those darker thoughts and those darker experiences that maybe, like, help you along the path to a more healthy and sophisticated and nuanced sense of self and identity. And man, I hope that's true. I, having come back to, like, especially having, like, started publishing again, I hope that's true. And, like, I've talked to people, and people have said that that's true, that that really is what they're getting out of this. And I certainly, I'm not the kind of motherfucker to be like, oh, but, you know, in reality, this is bad. Like, you may say this is good for you, but maybe it's actually bad. But, like, in my own moments of self-reflection, there is always that niggling fear there. And because of the way that Eris passed, and because I felt like I had opportunities that maybe I didn't take to...
Like what?
Just as somebody, you know, just as somebody who, like, ran a space that she frequented, as somebody who she seemed to respect. Like, did I have an opportunity to, like, I'm not going to sit someone down and preach to them, right? And I'm especially not going to do it as someone who's never, I'm not going to, like, go to someone and say, like, this is a come to Jesus moment. You have a problem with addiction. I'm never going to fucking say that as someone who has never touched a controlled substance in my life. I'm just going to look like an asshole if I do that, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to look like a hypocrite or a square, or like somebody who profoundly just doesn't understand. But I do wonder if, like, were there times when I should have said something, when I could have intervened? And I'm sure a lot of people in her life feel that way.
She was going to rehab, like, that week.
Yeah. And that fucking hurts. You know, it does. It does.
I think it was an outlet for her. I think Misery Loves Company. I don't think it was guiding her, because I think she would have written those stories without Misery Loves Company, because she was publishing in, like, witchcraft.
Oh, stuff. Yeah. She was publishing before we came on the scene at all.
But it definitely motivated her, I believe, because she loved you guys.
She did. And I know that. And we loved her, you know, and... I think it's natural, like, to feel some guilt and regret about it, especially as we're coming in on 2 years now, or 3 years, 2 years, I think. It was 2022, right? July 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
It was July, fuck.
Yeah, it was the beginning of July, or it was the end of June. I think it was the first week in July that she passed.
Yeah. I just remember, like, over, like, that next year, just, like, spending many, many hours in the after party with, like, Gigi and John. And I feel like our Babadooks, like, came out and they, like, battle each other. We did it get pretty intense.
Everyone was grieving, right? She had such a profound influence on so many lives. There were so many people who loved her, who respected her, who thought highly of her as an artist, and who thought highly of her as a human being. And I hope she saw that, right? Like, I hope some of that light was reflected back to her and she understood it. Because it would be sad to think that she didn't, you know, it would be sad to think that she just gave so much of herself to the world and didn't get anything back in return, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a profoundly depressing thought, so I hope it's not true.
What do you think? Is there life after death, in your opinion?
I don't know. If it was a strictly binary choice and you put a gun to my head and you said say yes or no, I would say no.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, I have no idea. I'm not an atheist. I guess I consider myself agnostic. I have not seen much in my life that gives me reason to believe in a benevolent God. But I've also seen, like, tremendous beauty in this world. Like, I just, like, when I was outside a few minutes ago checking on the chickens, like, just, like, looking around the lawn, just, you know, the layering of the texturing of the clouds in the sky, just the trees, all this hokey romantic shit. It's true. Like, we live in a world where we are assaulted by beauty on a daily basis. And you have to be very calloused or very oblivious not to see that. And it's hard to look at that beauty, that profound, layered, ever-present beauty, and think it's purely accidental, to think it arose, like, entirely and completely by chance, which is not me saying that it didn't. But on the other hand, like, ethically, morally, like, it's hard to look at a world that's, like, predicated on predation. Like, we're one of the, like, fundamental facts of reality is death. And death and consumption are the means of perpetuating life. You know, like, that is one of the most fundamental and unchangeable facts about reality. Like, how can you look at a universe that's structured in that way and imagine a moral guiding hand behind it? So I don't know. But ultimately, like, at the end of the day, like, I don't know. I do not know. I don't have the confidence to say that there is a God or there isn't a God. And certainly as far as the afterlife is concerned, I don't have, I can't confidently say. I want to believe that there's something better after this for the sake of people like Eris, who deserve so much more than they were given in the brief time that they had. Personally, like, I'm kind of fingers crossed, like, I'm 40 years old soon. My grandfather is still alive at 88. Maybe the singularity gets here and maybe I get my consciousness gets uploaded to the cloud and it's San Junipero or something. Like, as hokey as that sounds, that's the only afterlife I have any hope for. And I think it's a long shot.
Can you speak to the beauty that you see in Rudy?
In Rudy? Rudy's brilliant. I mean, Rudy's a fucking genius. That's the beauty there. I mean, Rudy has an unparalleled ability to find completely novel connections in this world. Like he, if you've been to Misery Loves Company, so you've heard him read his writing, so you know like that he can write a piece that is like this incredibly complex web of like interconnected concepts, and yet at the same time it's like incredibly funny, right? Mm-hmm. That's like, it's not like a serious face, it can be incredibly dense in the way that these connections are layered, and yet still be a really breezy, funny, and absurd piece. I think that's like, there's no question in my mind that like Rudy's a fucking genius.
Why don't you guys live together?
Why don't we live together? I mean, we actually like have really profoundly different interpersonal stuff. We would kill each other if we lived together. Because Rudy, because I'm a like anal retentive control freak who constantly is craving solitude, who has an autistic, like borderline autistic aversion to noise and clutter and distraction, and because he's like the opposite of that, right? He's somebody who has like very regular and very deep social needs. He's somebody who like enjoys like perpetuating a certain amount of chaos and disorder in the world around him. And we're both pathological in the way that we express those things, right? And so if we were in the same space, we had to occupy the same space for the same time, for an extended period of time, it would not be good.
Have you guys fought before?
Oh yeah. Holy shit, man. You have no idea. Yes. Rudy and I have absolutely fought before. We fought recently, you know,
What's your worst fight?
I can't necessarily pick a single worst fight. And I also don't want to say anything that's going to like violate Rudy's privacy, right?
What would make him laugh? A fight that would like, he would laugh if he was listening to this.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of our like disagreements, the disagreements we've had are rooted in one of two different things. One is the thing that I've already talked about, which is that we have like very different needs in terms of like social interaction, and we've been on divergent paths over the course of our lives, right? Like Rudy has become more and more, well, because you know, Rudy's parents are dead now, right? Mm-hmm. And he's living alone, and he's living in a very isolated and shitty situation. And so he has a lot of really like ungratified, unmet social needs, right? And I, on the other hand, like I'm back now living with my parents. And as somebody who like already had a deep need to like isolate a lot of the time and have solitude, being in an environment that is kind of cluttered and kind of chaotic and kind of noisy, and that has people that I can't really get away from, like, I've been driven more and more to isolate and withdraw, whereas he's been driven more and more outward towards that kind of social seeking stuff. And so we've butted heads more than once about that. You know,
he's like going out and seeking other friends or something?
He is. And I don't want to get into like, I don't want this, I want to like be as respectful of Rudy's privacy about his own life as possible, right?
Is he like going out and partying at bars or something?
No, he can't do. He doesn't do that, and he shouldn't do that because he's on like medications that might interact badly with alcohol if he was consuming alcohol, right?
But if he was, would you interfere? Would you like, that's your life, let you do what you want?
I don't know.
It's like the Eris thing.
It is a good question. And, you know, there is some of that moral responsibility that I feel like regarding Rudy, too, because I know that both of us are going through a difficult time in our mm-hmm. lives right now. I've known him since second grade, right? And so I do feel a sense of, like, real responsibility for him. And I'm sure he feels a real sense of responsibility for me. And I'm sure it pains him to see me doing, like you know, hurting myself in various ways or suffering in various ways, just as it pains me to see him suffering in various ways. How do you intervene? What do you do thing is something that I have to negotiate every day, not just with Rudy and with other relationships that I have with my life and throughout my life. This is something that I've really struggled with over the course of the past few years too, right? Because I think before that, and not just before Eris, but like in 2020, multiple people in my life died, right? Like a coworker I was close to died. My grandmother died. My aunt died. My partner and I, we lost one of our cats. And all within like a few months. And I walked away from that, even though none of these deaths were preventable, right? Like I didn't kill any of these people. Like cancer got a couple of them, heart disease got another one. And my grandmother was very old and suffering from probably dementia and had been in a nursing home in declining health for years. So like, I still, though, felt a real profound sense of guilt and responsibility after those deaths, because in a lot of cases there were things left unaddressed or unsaid, or I looked back at how I had dealt with that person in the past, and I felt a profound sense of, like, I had responsibilities to these people, and I shirked them on some level out of, like, selfishness, out of a need to isolate, or out of a need to, like, protect myself or safety-seeking behaviors. And since then, I've been trying not to do that as much. I've been trying to feel some responsibility for the other people in my life. But it's a daily battle because that's not my impulse.
Mm-hmm.
That's not like who I am when I'm not thinking about it, right? Like that's not me left to my own devices acting naturally. Like I am like, and this isn't like me trying to be self-effacing or whatever. I am like at my core, a deeply like egocentric person, and all of that is hard. Like it's a conscious process I have to remind myself of every day, and it applies to my relationship with Rudy too, you know.
You said your partner, are you married?
No, my partner at the time I was living with someone for a few years there in Maryland and then in Virginia, someone who I'd been seeing for a few years prior to that, back when I was living in Manchester. I want to be careful because it's another thing where like I want to respect their privacy as well.
The pronouns you use. I'm noticing.
Tyler, I was wondering if we would get here because you've brought this one. Okay. All right. You've tiptoed around this issue before. Yeah.
It's something I bring up in the after party sometimes, and people get very defensive of you, and they like want to protect you. They don't like when I bring it up. So, are you bisexual or gay?
I'm not. I'm going to choose not to answer that question, Tyler, and I'm going to let you know why I'm choosing not to answer that question. I don't want my work as a creator to be viewed through the lens of my answer to that question.
Okay.
As an editor, as a writer, as a content creator or whatever, if you want my honest answer, I believe that 90-some, like I think Kinsey was pretty much right. I believe that like 90-some percent of the human population is at least like residually homosexual or residually gay. Mm-hmm. I don't really, but bisexual, like And like sexuality is a topic that I don't really super duper enjoy discussing. As somebody who like I don't write about it much, I don't cover it much in my work. I certainly have no problem like publishing pieces on misery tourism that are like sexually explicit or that deal with like with sexual themes or that deal with sexuality in any number of different ways and identity in any number of different ways. But I don't want it to be a definitional thing for me in any way, because like also like what does that, if I answered that question, what would it give anyone if I said I'm 100% straight, I've never had a gay thought in my life? What does that give the listener? And if I said I'm bi, like I'm actually perfectly 50-50, I'm just as attracted to men as to women, or if I said I'm 100% gay, guys, like or anywhere along that spectrum, what does the listener get? I mean, I guess if like I say a thing and that's you too, then you get it, feel a little validated, right? You feel a little bit like, oh, okay, I can see myself in that. But I don't think it gives anyone anything. I don't think it has any real value, you know, which is, and I'm also like, to be honest, I'm a deeply private and personal guy when it comes to like my actual personal life, as opposed to like, my disillusionment at Occupy Wall Street or stuff that shaped me as an ideological or person, you know.
Growing up in a conservative place, you didn't feel shame over how you felt or your attraction towards other people?
I didn't. I'm going to be honest and say, to the degree that I, like, okay, let me be careful.
It's okay if you don't want to talk about it.
No, I was a real late bloomer in terms of like having any kind of like even romantic interests at all. Like I didn't date in high school. I didn't like, and it wasn't like I wanted to date in high school and I couldn't like, it was like I didn't have any desire to be in anything resembling like a romantic relationship, let alone like a sexual relationship, until I was like in college, right? Mm-hmm. I have a lot of undifferentiated shame about sexuality, period. Right. And it wouldn't matter what the target of that sexuality was. Right. Like that is an area of real like, it's a psychologically like touchy area for me in some ways, period. Like, but no, that's the answer I'm sticking with, because it actually doesn't give you any information about the previous question you asked.
Yeah. That's all right. But I think however you identify, I think it does help like with the podcast that I did with Rudy and the finding out some of the things about Rudy that I had not previously known. Maybe you guys share something familiar in here.
If you're like asking in a roundabout way if Rudy and I have ever been involved.
No. Because Rudy, I think Rudy brought up that he doesn't identify as man or woman.
Yeah. Rudy, I don't want to dig too much into Rudy's gender stuff because I don't know exactly what he disclosed in that podcast. But no, and you know, gender is interesting for me because I honestly don't think I've ever felt anything resembling gender dysphoria. The way that I've read about it, the way that I've had like friends and people I've known closely describe it to me. On the other hand, I've never really felt like profoundly masculine. I've never felt any desire to perform masculinity in the way that I've heard people write about performing masculinity. And if anything, like I've felt some desire to like shy away from things that I perceived as being like really masculine coded, but that didn't come with like a sense of like shame or confusion about my own identity or anything, right? So gender is a real black box to me. A lot of the feelings people have about gender, a lot of the like deep anxieties they have about it, a lot of the ways in which like they feel it's intrinsic to their sense of self and the ways that they feel like it's a unique source of pain or pleasure, right, are profoundly alien to me, like profoundly alien to me. And I don't say that in a judgmental way. I don't say that in a dismissive way. I'm only talking about my own experience. But I've always been very happy. This is a fucked up thing to say because I know how many people this is not true for, but I've always been very happy inside my own body, right? Mm-hmm. Like as I get older and it's harder to keep weight off and things like that. It's like some of that's like, there's times when I like look and I like, man, I wish I could lose 5 pounds or 10 pounds or 15 pounds or whatever. But like in terms of that, like I've always been like, I've always felt very comfortable in my own body and with like who I am, and never felt a really profound desire to like validate that or express that or challenge that or fight that or go to war with it or anything. I just okay with it. And once again, that includes like not having any real desire to be viewed as being like masculine, you know, like, I don't know. I think I'm just like, you roll the dice and sometimes you get some bum rolls, you know, and you get, and sometimes you get lucky. And I think like gender dysphoria is an area where I got a very lucky roll and where it's one thing I don't have to angst about, although there certainly are plenty of other things that I do.
But does Rudy come with you to any, like with any questions or concerns or anxieties that you help them with or him with?
I'm going to punt on that question. Once again, I know where my lines are in regarding my own privacy, but I can't on the fly judge exactly where Rudy's lines are concerning his privacy. So that's where I'll leave it at that. I don't want to
do anything. I'll have you both on and then we can go over it.
There you go. Yeah. Have us both on. And in that instance, I can talk about things like that.
So it's been around 2 hours, I think.
Has it?
I think, yeah, maybe.
A little, just a little under 2 hours. Yeah.
You want to wrap it up or keep going?
I probably good to like,
Wrap it up
around now. I think that's probably a healthy length for a podcast. And
yeah,
because if you get me going on another topic, I'm just going to go off for another 20 minutes and ramble. So
why don't you do your own, like, I mean, you've done your own podcasts. You've done a lot of podcasts off and on. Why not just do like a consistent one where you go like 20 minutes and just on like a monologue or something?
I believe it or not, like the YouTube channel is the closest thing to that.
Yeah.
And that's challenging. It's actually not impossible, but it's hard for me to go off like this in a vacuum because, yeah, if you weren't here and I was staring at a camera or staring at a blank screen, the little guy in my head who is like hyper attentive to this stuff and hyper vigilant about the words I'm saying and what they mean and whether they're the right words or not, he would step in immediately and it would become hell, right? And that's what happens when I record YouTube videos and try to speak extemporaneously. That like overseer, the same like force that makes writing hard for me, makes that somewhat challenging too, because you become hyper attuned to every word you're saying and you start wondering if there's a better word you could use.
Well, thank you for coming on. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you, man. This has been fun. I'm sorry for not letting you get a word in edgewise here.
Oh, that's fine. That's how I usually am.
Great, great. No, this was a lot of fun, man. I really enjoyed it. Sorry I made you wait like 2 years to do this. But...
Oh, you're good, man.
All right.
I'll see you Friday.
Right. Is that it then?
Yeah, you're good.
All right. Have a good one.
You too, man. And that was William Duray. With Misery, tourism company. That was awesome. Yeah, I asked like three questions, and like he went off. That was great. That was so easy. I'm gonna have Rudy and him back talk about their sexualities. Okay. He's such an open person that it was like I found the one thing that I won't speak on, which is pretty cool. And it's very interesting that he runs like Misery Tourism, yet was speaking about like self-love and all that. It reminded me of Gigi, actually. When you really break Gigi Rowland down, that he starts to talk like that in a way. After like 3 hours of yelling and screaming. All right. Well, I'm out of here. Thank you for listening. Bye.